Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.
That would be the case,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Thursday, this 22nd day in the month of February. Do you know February is the hardest month to pronounce and spell?
Harder than August?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
I'm going to put a survey out there and see if people really agree with you. I think you just put out information that's not factual true, stated it as fact.
Oh, no. How can you be?
I have trouble with everything
how
other than
would
June.
You pronounce so, August?
I don't know. It just seems like it's got that U in there.
August?
Yeah, see? See? Right there.
It's if you're in a foreign
We could make this our first poll question for the day. Our Facebook likes skyrocket for all the kids
that.
Out there worried about spelling the month. So I'll tell you, I had to help my kids the other day with their homework. And every month, over three letters. So you got May and then everything else. You kind of got to stop and think about for a minute. You're like, okay, let me make sure daddy's really spelling this right. Which is terrifying because I come to the same thing on math. So I sit down to do math with my kids. Basic math, but I don't do basic math on a daily basis anymore. I'm in the arts. Why would I, right? In fact, my math scores are why I went into the arts. So I sit down with my kids to do very basic math, and I'm like, let daddy check this real quick, because you realize you get out of that school mode. You know,
I don't even know what that math is that they know learned today.
Terrifying.
Why did they have to change it? It doesn't even make any sense.
New math. Yeah, that's exactly right. How you been, Michael? You're looking good.
Well, thank you. These are not my glasses. Disclaimer. Okay. Yeah.
It's radio. You can tell people you're not wearing glasses at all.
That's
tell people you're not wearing pants at all. Nobody's going to care, man. Let's go.
Then we get some Facebook comments. We used to do that. We used to have Pantsless Thursdays.
What a great tradition. How did we lose that?
I don't know.
Paul Strolley left. That's how.
That's right.
Hey, we got some fun stuff going on today. Like you said, it's February 22nd, and we have been seeing some chilly weather, haven't we, Michael?
Yeah, I don't like it, though. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it comes in the early part of the morning, and it's freezing. Even the house, the heating in the house.
Yeah.
I won't put on the heat during the sleeping process because you wake up and you're just dried out, right? So, you know, and I don't like heavy blankets over me, so I'm just kind of enduring it. I do get up and put covers over my two dogs, however. They're beagles.
Right.
Yeah.
They get cold. They got short
hair.
They
are. Though they have a coat, which I don't, you know, they need it. So
you're a good papa. Good papa.
Thank you. So we have a crazy kind of weather going on and makes you kind of want to get inside and stay there for a while and maybe see some what? Great theater?
That's the way to do it for sure.
Yeah.
And today we have a couple of guests from A Streetcar Named Desire to tell us about this amazing show on stage now at the Boston Court Performing Arts Center through March 25th.
Absolutely. Please.
Hey,
I love that.
Mr. Brando.
That's right.
He has heard us from above.
He always comes in whenever you say streetcar, right?
Please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the studio today, Michael McKetty and Maya Lynn Robinson.
All right. Welcome, welcome.
Yes.
So glad to have you both here. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Now, you got to tell me, this is not a traditional streetcar production, correct? There's a lot of cool stuff you guys are doing to update this production and to kind of play some themes that maybe don't get that kind of play every day, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Cool. You know, there are a lot of things that Williams intended in the play that I think audiences at the time saw it as sort of revolutionary. And the play is still produced all the time, and it's a beautiful, amazingly crafted play. But there are a lot of those themes that we don't see so much anymore because it feels kind of like, an old-fashioned Southern Gothic play, you know? And he was dealing with some really serious stuff about how the makeup of our cities were changing and evolving after World War II, and how there was a difficulty in people accepting a world that was changing around them, and themes that are really important now. So we're doing some things to shake it up.
Cool. Those themes out. It's interesting how you can shake it up and make it more modern, but at the same time still emphasize the traditional theme, which was that people are people and relationships are hard wherever you are.
Yep,
it's an interesting thing. I'm excited to hear more about that. And we'll obviously get back to our guest in just a moment. But before we do that, Michael, shall we pay some bills?
I think we better, So we'd like to thank, ladies and gentlemen, Princess Cruises for coming on board as presenting sponsors for State of the Arts during 2018. A pioneer in excellence on the high seas for meaningful travelers who are seeking enriching experiences. Only Princess Cruises offers cruise vacations to help you come back new. providing fresh perspectives by connecting you with nature, cultures, and loved ones in a new way.
One of the best-known names in cruising, Princess Cruises first set sail in 1965 with a single ship cruising to Mexico. Today, the line has grown to become the third largest cruise line in the world, renowned for innovative ships, an array of onboard options including extravagant entertainment, and an environment of exceptional customer service. A recognized leader in worldwide cruising, Princess carries approximately 1.7 million guests for more than 360 destinations worldwide each year aboard a fleet of 17 modern vessels.
That's a lot of sailing.
That's right.
Isn't it?
A lot of water time.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you know what I love about them is their entertainment. The attention they give to producing entertainment on board the ships, it's magnificent.
And the love everybody over there has for the live arts and live entertainment.
Yeah.
If not for cruise ships, a lot of these plays would not have a second life. And I think that they get some of the best performers out there. Really great experience.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, we'd like to also acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to State of the Arts.
That's right. Obviously, such a great resource, Michael, to be sure. And speaking of great things, I know you had a busy week. Was it a theatrically interesting week?
Well, to some extent. You know, I have the Supper Club, Sterling's upstairs at the Federal, and we had a wonderful show come in for its second time. It's part of a series, a trilogy right now.
Was I in it?
No.
Unbelievable.
I almost called you, but no, you were not in it. Nothing I put together. I'm just supporting it and presenting it. It is for the Foundation of New American Musicals and a benefit, and it's called Third Mondays.
Right.
So we bring in Broadway performers to sing from the past and to sing from the present, and then the future being shows that are being shepherded by the organization
mm-hmm.
itself. And it's a pretty great concept. And people like Richard Israel, director of note in Los Angeles, you know, hosts, or Kevin Bailey, some mm-hmm. of these great performers who do have other jobs, they come in and sing. Not Richard doesn't sing, but it's a very sweet evening of songs that a lot of people haven't heard before.
That's
or they
right.
forget about them.
And a glimpse into the future, too, to see what's coming to Broadway,
exactly.
how the world's changing, what theatrical events
exactly.
are coming around the corner. I think that's a very,
very
cool thing.
So. And then we had, of course, Miscast come in to the
mm-hmm.
club.
A show named after my career. Yeah. Well, he was good, but he was miscast. You know, totally
really?
Miscast there.
I don't know whether you've ever heard of that show before, Miscast, but it is a riot.
Right.
It's several performers doing performances in roles that they would never be cast in, and or some major twist to the actual performance of a song that they're doing.
And so different every time, right? It's
different
songs
every time.
Each time. Of course, Justin Michael Wilcox, who
yes.
we love so much, was in it along with so many other people, great
yeah.
performers. Yeah.
yeah. So that was kind of my weekend, and I did not get a chance to go out and see theater or a movie, and I'm dying to see
wow.
a movie.
Lots of movies to get out
the
there.
The Oscars
and see. Yeah.
before they hit. But,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
We'll have to figure that one out.
Well, I had a good time this week, too, as I was down to the Redondo Beach Performing Arts Center to
uh-huh.
see
yes.
a special event. You know, there's a little bit of rock and roll for you here, Michael. I tell you, I've had rock and roll in my car all week now. Come on. Nobody's going to dance with me? That's all right. I'll do
it.
I'll do
was.
It.
That's a, Million-Dollar Quartet. That's what you're talking about.
I got to tell you, Million-Dollar Quartet was not something that I'd ever seen before. Heard the soundtrack. Have you guys seen the show? So this is interesting because it talks about the one date in December of 1954, I believe. When
56.
56. Yeah. When Elvis, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, and then Jerry Lee Lewis came into the studio at Sun Records with Sam Phillips and were there for a period of time together. And you think how much entertainment and drama can you get out of a couple hours? Boy, you put those four in a room together, you can get miles and miles of entertainment out of it. So,
well, you know, we did
fun time.
I represent the show for publicity and public relations as our client, and I was so enamored by this production, though I'd seen it, you know, the national tour come through and was mesmerized then, but to have these boys
yeah.
Who were cast in the show all who have had experience with this show somewhere, on Broadway or in Chicago in its original introduction to the masses, where it became one of Broadway or one of Chicago's longest running shows, 17 years.
Well, and it should, because it's definitely a play. There's definitely a story, but there's also just great music. I mean, Cole absolutely channels Elvis. You know, I mean,
yes,
it's amazing to watch. You see, it's not an impression. It's a picture of the man. It's a portrait of the human being.
John Countryman, who plays Jerry Lee Lewis.
Boy, he was obnoxious. So great.
This guy home.
Yeah, and at the same time, punch him in the nose. He was fantastic. He did Jerry Lee Lewis is the cousin of Jimmy Swaggart, so he's got that sort of very over-the-top feel in his speech anyways. And, man, he captured that so well. Just really an endearing character.
Not only as an actor, but as a musician.
Boy!
Because all of them played their own instruments, of course, and to master that kind of piano playing... Man.
Well, Mr. Dawson told the story. He said there was people who came out on opening night going, okay, there's no way they actually played that. This is pre-recorded or something, which is funny because the music is played right there in front of you. You still don't believe it. Pretty cool thing.
Well, to that, and thank you for going, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. We open at the beautiful Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts this week, the 23rd
That's right.
through March 4th.
And I believe that, you know, if you want to go down to Redondo to catch the rest of 3D's season, this is the last time they're going to be there.
Last
is that
time
correct?
They'll be in Redondo. Because the parade is coming up, and then Mamma Mia follows up.
And parade will be a special thing. That's obviously
very
got our good friend Davis Gaines in it, who's amazing, and a lot of other really talented cast members. 3D Theatricals, they're a little bit of a jaunt to get down there to Orange County, but boy, worth the trip every minute. This show's cool because it's 90 minutes. It's it's
no
one
intermission.
Act, no intermission. Yeah. The audience loved it. In fact, the gentleman sitting next to me said he lived in Memphis during this time, was aware that this was happening. He was 85 years old, and he said I had to come see this because I went out and I searched for these recordings, and I couldn't find the recordings of this thing that had happened just a few feet away from my home. And then they released the CDs in the 90s, and he said I went out and grabbed it. He had tears in his eyes. He was having such a good
time.
It was a monumental event. You didn't ask me who my date was.
Who was your
date?
Oh, wouldn't you? Oh, I thought you were going to take your daughter.
No, I took my little boy.
His
first experience at the theater by himself. This little blonde-haired boy sitting there going, wow, watching Elvis and Carl and Jerry Lee. I mean, it was amazing. And I wasn't sure if I was going to take him because sitting through a show at 7 years old, it's hard for me at 39 years old. It's definitely hard for a seven-year-old to sit through a show. And I watch him, and man, when that music came on, those feet started bopping and that head started jiving. Yeah. He had such a good time. And it was fine because there is a little bit of language in this. It's not a specifically children's show.
Right.
But it's certainly, if you've talked to your kids, if you've had a relationship with them, it's nothing they're not going to hear at school, that sort of thing. And it was interesting, too, to watch him be exposed to live performance. Now, he's seen me multiple times. He's seen me die as Tybalt. He's seen me, you know, succeed as Bob Cratchit, and he's seen me win the crown in King Lear. But it's funny to watch when Daddy's not on stage how his attention is totally different, right? It just was like, who are these people, that love of theater? So hopefully, I think he was the youngest person in the audience. There's no doubt about that. But there was a lot of people there who just loved this music, started bopping their heads, and really did make this a fun and exciting atmosphere to see a show.
Well, you know, and I must give a little shout out to David Elkins, who portrays Johnny Cash, because boy does he nail that role.
And our buddy Zach Ford as well, who did a great job.
In a non-singing role, Zach.
Which is funny, because Zach's got such a great voice, too.
Indeed.
One thing we should say is if you want to get tickets for 3D Theatricals, how can you do that, Michael?
Simply go to their website, very easy, 3D Theatricals or 3DTshows.org.
Yeah.
And you can just click on the button to buy tickets, and you are there.
Get down there and see a little bit of rock and roll.
Yeah. It's actually a little longer than 90 minutes. It's in 105 minutes.
Well, maybe they sang fast for me. I don't know. Uh-huh. They were rocking and rolling. I tell you, it felt like it was 20 minutes, man. That show just flew by. It was a really well-paced show, but more than that, the music just drives you. I mean, I have Elvis in my car right now. I went home and put Reconsider Baby in my car just because it's such a great piece. So, yeah.
Reconsider Baby?
Yeah, you don't know that? That's his blues album. Oh, it's good.
You know that?
It's good.
You do?
Why Michael's do you know like, that? Yeah, I know that.
So you're an Elvis, you're an Elvis fan?
Of course.
Nikki, do you know that? He is the publicist.
Well, I'll bring in and we'll play a little bit.
Speak Our Name Desire. She's with us in the studio. We love having her. And what about you? Did you?
I didn't know.
Okay.
So we should have pulled Nikki on the calendar question and asked the hardest month to spell. I wonder if I can get any support for August. I think that U is hard to put in there. Maybe not. Could just be me. I don't know.
She's shaking her head.
We have some. Come on. No support. I get no love in this studio. We should bring in these talented people here to talk about an amazing show. Let's do it.
Yes, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen. Are you starting this?
No, I believe you are. Bottom of page four.
Bottom of page four. And you are. So
look at us bringing people behind the curtain in the studio. I like that. Yeah.
What did I do? I think I put that page away thinking of it. You know, okay, so here we go. Our first guest, ladies and gentlemen, is no stranger to Los Angeles theater, having directed shows across the Southland, including the theater at Boston Court, where he is co-artistic director.
At Boston Court, he directed The Dinosaur Within, Paradise Lost, Shadows and Wings, Summertime, The Golden Dragon, Romeo and Juliet, his own adaptation of Picture of Dorian Gray, and God Save Gertrude.
Also at Boston Court, he directed The House in Scarsdale, A Memoir for the Stage, My Barking Dog, American Misfit, Creation, Dark Play or Stories for Boys, 1001, and 20th Century Way, also at Rattlestick Playwrights Theater in New York.
Elsewhere, he has directed Figaro, The Grapes of Wrath, Hamlet, As You Like It, and Don Juan at Noise Within, King Charles III, and A Life in the Theater at Pasadena Playhouse, Building the Wall at Fountain Theater, District Merchants at South Coast Rep, and Kiss Me, Kate, Carousel, and Man of La Mancha with Reprise Theater Company.
He is the recipient of 2 Ovation Awards and 4 Los Angeles Drama Critics Circle Awards. He is also the very gifted director of Boston Court's current production, A Streetcar Named Desire. Please welcome Michael Michetti.
Yeah. Welcome, Michael. Welcome. I see you brought your fans with you today. Very nice. Great to have you here. You got to tell me how this production came about and what's different about this than maybe anybody's ever seen Streetcar before.
Yeah, so, I was rereading the play because I love it so much and thinking about how to make the themes more relevant for our time. And there was a line very early on. There are just a handful of lines in which we set up the New Orleans neighborhood and meet Stanley and Stella. And then Blanche enters, and he goes into this great description of her and says, her appearance is incongruous to this setting.
Wow.
And I thought, I wonder how incongruous we could make that. And first of all, the reason her appearance was incongruous even in the original production was that this was a... it is already set up as being a multicultural world. There is an African American person on the step, and Stanley in the original production is a Polish man, and which at the time was really kind of considered another race in the 1940s. So Blanche comes in and she's in all of her finery and looking like she's stepped out of a southern plantation, which she has. And so he was already making a point about how she doesn't belong in this world. And I began thinking, well, what if we really sort of put that idea on steroids? So what we are doing in this production is Blanche is an absolutely traditional Blanche, 1940s clothes, southern dialect, white woman, all of the behaviors we associate with that character. Everyone else in the play exists in 2018, multicultural, multiracial, unaccented. It's a very contemporary, modern, urban world. And so the world that she's holding on to, trying to keep propelling forward, is one that is long in the past. And she's having trouble accepting the world as it is moving on. So we really take these themes that are there in William's play and really accentuate them through the casting. So she is the only white person in the cast. She is, everyone else is some other race and or ethnic background. And everyone is an other in some way as well. We have, there are a lot of other ways in which we have a transgender actress and a number of other ways in which the world is not the world that Blanche has come from and feels comfortable with, because she comes from a very heterogeneous kind of society and has trouble accepting people who are different than she.
Which you have to think of as interesting, too, because that's what New Orleans was to everyone else in the country at that time
that's
when this
right.
play was written. I mean, it was the different planet. It was Mars to a lot mm-hmm. of people. So setting it there was a very definitive choice
right.
to say, hey, look, people are people, and wherever you go, you're going to run into people different than you, and how do you react in that scenario, and how do they react towards you? Very interesting.
May I ask that when you make these bold decisions with a classic like that, do you have to get the permission
yeah.
from the licensing
right.
company?
You do. So it's a kind of complicated, but the play is licensed in the U.S. by Samuel French. But the licensing agreement says that you cannot change race, time period, music, accents, any of those things, all of which we needed to change in this. So in order to get approval for those things, you go to the lawyers who are in London who represent the Williams estate.
Right.
And so we went to them and made the pitch on this. And essentially the pitch was not only about the concept of the play, but as I said earlier, that I think it allows us to see themes that Williams intended in the play that I'm not sure we notice any longer. And so based on that, they said, yes, go for it.
And did you feel that they were open to this? Was this something they'd experienced with some of other Williams' play?
I'm not sure what their process was. We went back and forth a little bit, and then they gave the approval. They certainly gave us the approval. I know that particularly with the top Williams plays, they're very protective of them.
Right, I can imagine.
Because they do get produced a lot, but it's, they're continuing the reputation of the plays and the estate and all of those things. So they're very protective when they do it. Now, it's not the first time that people have messed with some of those things. There was on Broadway an all African-American production a number of years ago, but it's the first one that I'm aware of that has dealt with it in quite this way.
Interesting. Yeah.
Maybe you should try to take it to the West End.
Since
the lawyers are there.
Yeah, that's right.
Go where the lawyers are. I've never heard that before. So this is obviously a cool production, and it's not the only thing Boston Court has done like this. Obviously, you guys have made a reputation in recent years. What is, as an artistic director there, what is your goal for Boston Court, and what do you want to be known as at that theater?
Well, we try to give people an experience that they really couldn't have anywhere else in Southern California. So we do a lot of new work, which means both world premieres of plays as well as plays that have had very few productions and are not sort of the... We don't tend to do the play that is the darling of the regional theater circuit. We try to discover things that people wouldn't have a chance to discover otherwise. But we do have a reputation of doing quite a few through the years, new takes on classics. And sometimes that is a new adaptation of a classic with a brand new text that's inspired by a classic play. But there have been a number of times, like in this one, where we are using Williams' text exactly as he wrote it. We're not changing a word of it, but taking a very radically new approach so that it feels like a fresh play.
Well, I think that's first of all, very, very important to bring in a younger audience that mm-hmm. can relate to it in this mm-hmm. kind of way. It's so important that the youth in this country be exposed to the arts for more than one reason.
I agree.
But certainly that is an appropriate opening of a door that might not otherwise be open to them.
I feel that way as well. It's, to come in and see a play that feels more relevant to them than they thought it might have been is really great. And I will also say that as a lifelong theater goer and having seen many productions of this play, there is a special sort of jolt that I get when I go to see a play that I know really well and a production makes me hear and see new things in it
Absolutely.
That I hadn't discovered yeah. before. And so I hope that will also be a special pleasure for those who think they know the play.
Very cool.
The
show
nice
we're talking
challenge.
About. That's right. The show we're talking about is, of course, A Streetcar Named Desire by Tennessee Williams. And it's performed at the Boston Court Performing Arts Center, located there in Pasadena, a beautiful space. You can go to their website, which is www.bostoncourt.com. That's court, C-O-U-R-T. Or you can always call 626-683-6801. Tickets are priced amazingly well, right? $20 to $39.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can't beat that.
That's right.
And as we often say on this show, to get up off of that couch, get away from that TV, put down that remote, and go to the theater and support the live arts, because the wonderful thing about it is a production can be performed for 6 weeks in a row, and no two performances will be alike.
That's right.
it's something fresh, it's real, it's important for your brain.
Yeah.
and to de-stress you, I think, as well.
And it's definitely, and no doubt in this weather, it's a great time to get out and put your coat on and go to the theater and sit in a nice climate-controlled area, watch a show, and then go out and walk the streets with, you know, you got to have a little bit of chilly weather to walk this beautiful city. There's great food around Boston Court as well, as I recall, too.
There's a lot of restaurants in walking distance.
That's right. And I love this area, too, because Pasadena, of course, with the wonderful venues they have there, it really is an old city. You get a lot of things. You walk down to Colorado Boulevard, lots of fun things going on.
The press opening is coming up on the 24th, and then it goes full steam through March 25th.
That's right. And of course, with just doing previews now, I believe, I wanted to kind of talk about kind of what you're expecting and what you've seen from people, maybe guests who have been in there for rehearsals and that sort of thing. What are people saying about their reactions to seeing the show presented this way? Are they surprised? Are they shocked? Is it something that they find new meaning in? How are people responding?
Yeah, I mean, I think that so far we are seeing that people really are responding as we hoped, which is that the play is feeling very fresh and new to them, and they're hearing it in a new way, which is exciting. And there's a lot of praise for our wonderful cast, who are doing such a terrific job and really bringing this play to life and investing themselves in it. So yeah, it's exciting.
Very cool. That's a great thing to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
shall we do a live arts calendar?
I think so.
Michael, will you be so kind as to hang around while we talk to your
absolutely
beautiful leading lady here in a minute, too?
Happy
good,
to.
Good. Here we go.
The Ruskin Group Theater kicks off its 2018 season with an all-star cast performance of The Alamo.
In this blue-collar Bay Ridge section of Brooklyn sits a rundown neighborhood institution called The Alamo, the last great American bar. The owners, along with some of their regulars, watched from the rooftop as the World Trade Towers fell, taking with it their relatives, friends, and neighbors.
Today, with an aging clientele, the place is fighting to keep its doors open. The only hope seems to be the arrival of artist gentrifiers. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Artist gentrifiers who are moving into the neighborhood and wanting to adopt the bar as an entertainment hangout. Bay Ridge locals and Alamo regulars don't want to surrender their bar, much less their neighborhood, to these young neo-carpetbaggers without a fight.
Touching on themes of nativism, racism, and the war, The Alamo paints a humorous and dramatic portrait of eight working-class Bay Ridge natives who always seem to find themselves on the front lines of change in America.
Don't miss this world premiere run of The Alamo, featuring an all-star cast at the Ruskin Group Theater in Santa Monica, on stage February 24th through March 24th. For tickets or more information, call 310-397-3244 or visit RuskinGroupTheater.com.
That's right. Obviously, a lot of great opportunities, Michael, for people to get out, get up, and go see a show somewhere, including the show we're talking about here today, A Streetcar Named Desire at the Boston Court Performing Arts Center.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, our next guest is an L.A.-based actress, writer, and producer. Recently, she has been seen in Runaway Home and in The Red and Brown Water with Fountain Theater, Disgraced with Coachella Valley Rep, and Echolocation with B Street Theater.
She appeared in Metamorphosis with Ensemble Theater Santa Barbara, Future Sex Incorporated with Lounge Theater, and Shotgun with Florida Studio Theater.
She is the writer and creator of two solo shows, Demographics and Character Breakdown, as well as two books of poetry, Brother Be a Stoplight and Sister Save Yourself.
She is also a Los Angeles Drama Critics Circle Award winner and is also currently appearing as Stella in Boston Court's production of A Streetcar Named Desire, which she will be talking about today with us here. Please welcome Maya Lynn Robinson.
Yeah.
Well, they love you.
Welcome, welcome,
you
welcome.
You sound so much cooler than I am.
No, that is not true. In fact, I have a cool tester and you exactly measured up. There's no doubt about it. Now, I read some of your poetry last night. This was very cool.
Thank you.
Got to tell me how you came up with the ideas for those, because I think that's an important thing as we begin to talk about Stella.
So a lot of my poetry stems from being an African American female in this world, and
a beautiful one, I must add.
Thank you.
Such a burden to be a beautiful woman these days. I know.
when you think of Sandra Bland, Trayvon Martin, things of that nature, I'm not an activist in the traditional sense. I get anxiety around large crowds for long periods of time, so you won't find me necessarily on the front lines of a march. But So I'm a little bit of a different type of activist, and I like to use my words. I like to use poetry in order to evoke feeling, emotion, and change.
Wonderful. And that's definitely what your poetry does. Now, I'm a white male, and I've been that almost my entire life. It's interesting, when I read it, I definitely got that there was a social, and that there was a commentary, a social commentary coming through, but also that there was the heart of a person. And I think that, and this wasn't for children specifically,
no.
Right? So it's like, it's got themes that are more complex, but at the same time, the morality of it certainly applied across all racial and gender bounds. Was that your intent, or were you just writing kind of from your heart to see what came of it?
Yes, to both. I was writing from my heart, and it was also the intention. It was never the intention to be specifically just for African-American.
Yeah.
And I actually write that in my notes at the very beginning. This is to anyone who, you know, can feed from this information. However, I did want my brothers and sisters, as I say, to know that they are heard, and if I could creatively give them a way to see the world in a different way that can get them to know when to stop, when to proceed with caution, and when to go full speed ahead in life, then I've done my job.
Well, and obviously, I think what you said there is so true, that we all speak to people who are from our language, right? People
yeah.
who understand our background. But more than that, we're all brothers and sisters. We all have a very large need to learn from one another, because my brother and I are very, very different, but at the same time, we come from a similar background. If we can give everybody that similar background, our dialogues can improve a lot, which I think is the goal of what you did there, and certainly achieved it. Now comes the question, though. How does that affect your portrayal of Stella, one
exactly.
of the greatest and most complex
exactly.
characters in American drama?
I think it. How does it affect how I play her? I definitely did not want to play her what I call dish rag Stella. I've seen quite a few productions where I've said, "Why are Stanley or Blanche fighting over her? She has no personality." She, you know, people sometimes forget that there are three leads in the show,
right.
and they just focus on the Stanley and Blanche moment. And so I asked Michael, you know, I said, if you're going to put me in this, or anyone that you're going to put in this, I just ask that she have a little bit of spice and a little bit of flavor to her that makes her a desirable trophy for her sister and for her husband to fight over.
That's right. Very interesting. Obviously,
and did he agree with that?
Well, you have to see and tell me.
Annie Caster, so I'd say yes. I got the feeling it's impossible to remove the spice from her, so I would say that's probably a given.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you real quick, this is a hard part to play because of partially what you spoke about, but for me, Stella's always been the every woman character, right? If it was a movie and the part fit, it would be Jimmy Stewart kind of playing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just that every man kind of person. And she really is stuck in an unusual circumstance, and obviously she's a ping pong ball between these two dominant personalities who have such strong desires and such strong wants. What was the part inside of you that you felt related to Stella the most?
Daphne Rubin Vega said it best. I did a lot of research on Stella interviews, and I can identify with Stella's sense of overwhelm. You know, you want to please everyone, you want to take care of everyone, and sometimes in that instance, you have to figure out how to take care of yourself. You have to realize that you're not taking care of yourself, and
right.
then you have to realize. Figure out how
yeah.
you can do that. And so she is a ping pong for not only Blanche and Stanley, but also she holds the community and neighborhood together. They have the poker parties at her house. You know, she's pregnant, so that there's this another being that's getting ready to come into the world.
And dominating everything about her. As a husband of a formerly pregnant wife, I can tell you, man, that changes everything.
Right?
Ooh, that play changed for me, yeah.
Everything. So just, you know, trying to figure out how to make everyone happy, I think has been the biggest challenge.
Yeah. yeah. No doubt about it.
Let me ask you something. You're so well-spoken, and obviously I think just from that I can tell you're a wonderful actress.
Thank you.
When did you know that you wanted to become an actress? What propelled you? Was this in your blood? Was it in your parents or anybody else?
My mom was going to school to get her bachelor's, and she was doing Jean Anouilh's Antigone for
wow.
extra credit.
Extra credit?
I mean,
extra, wow.
for her English class.
Very nice.
And the page of that was supposed to be the director's daughter. She got sick. So my mother volunteered me. And I remember Creon said, had the last lines of the play with me, and he said, what time is it? And I said, 5 o'clock, sir. And he said, what's on the agenda? And I said, cabinet meeting, sir. And then he has this monologue. And then the stage goes black, and everyone started clapping. And I realized the entire show, no one had clapped. And I just thought I was so magnanimous and magnificent and amazing that it was all for me, and I was hooked.
Which, generally speaking, is true. I think all the applause generally everywhere is for you.
Yes,
I could totally see that. That's a
and
great story.
10, so.
That sound is a unique sound.
Yes,
and it's
right?
One of those sounds that you hear, and it's got meaning, it's got depth, and it stretches through the ages. The sound of applause is one of the most, it's an unusual thing in our society, no doubt about it.
For me, it doesn't mean necessarily great job. It means that I was with you.
I was present.
And
that's
I think that
right.
That's what I've known ever since I was 10.
No doubt about
yeah.
it.
Do you sing at all?
I do.
Yeah, you must. I'm
I
sure.
Do.
And have you ventured into the world of musical comedy or musical theater?
Oh, I have. And I have a wonderful story for that later on in the program.
Oh.
From what I hear.
Nice.
So I'll tell you all about that, the last musical I did a year ago.
Very nice.
I, you know, it's funny. Our embarrassing moments tend to bring up some interesting stories from performers. I'm excited about that. The show we're talking about right now is A Streetcar Named Desire, written by Tennessee Williams, and now on stage at the Boston Court Performing Arts Center.
That's through March 25th.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
Good chance to go out and see that now.
Very much so.
So now as we look at this, I want to know a little bit about this.
Hey, Stella!
That always makes me laugh because at the time it was pivotal, right? But now it's kind of like Stallone's Adrian, you know, it's almost become so oversaturated that it doesn't have meaning. But that desperation and the moment of pain that he exhibits there is something that I think defined a generation. And Brando, of course, was the face of a generation when it came to that. This play has to be approached differently now, that sense of desperation, that sense of agony and what we get to in relationships. Working with your fellow cast members there at the Boston Court Performing Arts Center, how difficult was it to stay away from that sort of idea of cliche and that iconic portrayal of this? Did you intentionally try to not do bits that you'd seen on the film or in other stage productions?
Yes. I hadn't seen Streetcar, the film, in probably about 4 years, and so once I was cast, I made the choice that I was not going to watch it. But I did want to read interviews of the different actresses playing Stella, because as much research as I could get as possible, I thought would be better and easier for me along the way. Because, like you said, she is every woman, but how do you make an every woman interesting?
Right.
And not just feel every woman. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, the struggle for every actor who's playing a role that isn't the dominant personality role.
Right. We call her the beta.
That's a great term. Well, now you did an interesting exercise. You said to me who played Stanley in the musical or in the movie, and who played Blanche. And of course, you come up with those names very, very quickly. But I had a hard time coming up with the name of the actress playing Stella. And I love that you did that, because I think it shows that you walked into this knowing one of the difficult things about that role is you have to define her outside of these two other people. What a cool thing to be able to do.
Who did play Stella?
Vivian Stanley, is
and
that
she
right?
won
yeah.
an Academy Award for it, and people still
was
don't
that
know.
Good? Isn't
that's
that unbelievable?
Shame.
And yet, at the same time, I think that's also a great compliment, right? You can stand up to Brando, you can be artistically recognized, but you became the part, and nobody needs to know your name because you weren't a personality; you were the character. To me, that says something special, and I think any actress like that, actor, actress like that, I have a great respect for, because so often we rely on, "Hey, come like me as the person." If you give yourself over to that character, it's much more rewarding.
Did she have a career after that, though?
Yeah, absolutely. Although I didn't look up her IMDb stuff, but she was a stage actress as well as a film actress. So.
Interesting. Everyone thinks the Academy Award, you know, is the magic bullet for the rest of your career.
Right.
And
well,
sometimes it's not.
Aside from Vivian Leigh, the other three leading actors all had done it in the Broadway production and moved over. So that was the one exception where they recast for the name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty they took amazing. Jessica Tandy out and gave it to Vivian, right?
Yeah, right.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, so now we would obviously encourage everybody to jump on our Instagram account or our Facebook page and find out a little bit more about this show and that sort of thing. But one of the things that I want to talk about with Streetcar is the fact that this play has a very specific language, and the multicultural casting is wonderful and all that, but the language itself is tough to deal with. There's a lot of racially insensitive terms and all that sort of thing. How did you approach that with your cast, particularly in this world where we're hopefully doing everything we can to understand how to get rid of that?
Well, I mean, we've had lots of conversation around it because we don't want to be making any of these choices sort of naively and without a lot of thought. And we've had not only the input of all of our cast, but a really wonderful team around us that includes a lot of different perspectives, a lot of diversity, even within our production team, our dramaturg, my assistant director, et cetera. And we've had lots of voices and lots of conversations. I will say this as well, that there's a lot of behavior, frankly, on the part of every one of the characters that is not perfect behavior. And some of the ugliness of it you don't want to back away from, because that's part of the point. And so, you know, for me, so much of what we're dealing with in our country now is that there is a difficulty in having the difficult conversations.
Yeah.
You know, we are, I think we maybe naively during the Obama era believed that we were in a sort of post-racial world, and that's just not true. There are so many conversations that got swept under the carpet and that we didn't have, and we need to have them. And so even in this play, these characters are having trouble because their lenses to the world are so different. They don't even know how to have the conversation. And I think that's an important thing for us to look at in our world. And so we've tried to be really conscious of all of those things and not backpedal where the play wants it to be ugly and wants there to be conflicts. Drama is all created around conflict. And yet to do it in a way where we're really conscious about the repercussions of it.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Did you know at the first table read that you had done the right...
Oh, it was so exciting. I will tell you this. I have been dreaming on this play for a few years now, and very honestly, dreaming on it even prior to the idea of a Trump presidency or any of those things, which has really sort of brought into higher relief the themes in the play. But first of all, when I began to audition these amazing actors and hear them bring the text closer to their voice and make the poetry of the text, as you pointed out, Andrew, that the text is very, you know, the dialogue is very specific, and yet to hear people make it feel absolutely fresh and brand new was super exciting. And then to hear that happen around the table, hear the way that they interplayed with one another, it was very exciting. I knew that we had some really special actors and people who were going to bring a lot of themselves to this play.
And obviously you do that as well, Michael. I got to ask you real quick before we get back to the beautiful young woman sitting next to you there. Tell me what's next for Boston Court.
This is our first play of the 2018 season, and so we have two additional plays coming up. The West Coast premiere of a wonderful play called Her Portmanteau, and then a world premiere play called Everything That Never Happened.
Is it comprehensive?
Yeah, exactly. Boston Court is also a performing arts center, so we have over 30 music concerts happening through the year and a lot of different things. And if you go to the website, you can see all the different offerings we have coming
up. And again,
up.
That website is www.bostoncourt.com, right?
Correct.
Fantastic.
In Pasadena, which is an experience itself. It's such a lovely city. You kind of really feel removed from Los Angeles when you drive out there and surrounded by the San Gabriel Mountains.
Yeah.
It's a pretty nice place to go see theater.
Now, Maya Lynn, I got to ask you, one of my first professional jobs in L.A. when I got out here, I was 18 years old, and I played the young gentleman at the end of Streetcar Named Desire. I've always depended on the kindness of strangers, gentlemen. And it's one of my favorite stories because the actress who was playing Blanche, we auditioned with that scene. And she didn't know she was going to be doing this, so she walked in to do it. And she had to kind of jump into the scene, and of course there's a kiss at the end of that scene, and so like the first five guys, the first five performers, we got up there and she kissed us, and she was like, okay, do I have to do this for every person who auditions today? Because it's a lot of kissing, you know. And I always remember thinking, wow, I've walked into a very different world from my Midwestern planet. But it was very interesting because one of the things I found about Tennessee Williams in general is that every single part has such depth and meaning. Do you see that with, obviously, the two main characters that we've talked about, but Stella has so many things that I think people don't bring out, sometimes because she's not that big personality. Do you find yourself watching the other actors in the scenes you're not in and finding meaning in Tennessee Williams and how good his writing was?
I mean, I find it, like, while I'm in my scenes.
Right.
how good his writing is. And also how challenging it is, too, because sometimes it's like, are you saying a double negative? Is this really a positive? Wait, why is the sentence fragment...
Right.
Why is it this way?
Why did you conjugate it that way, Mr. Williams? That's
way?
Right.
Like, you know. But then it does kind of give you insight into the state of the character in that moment.
And so that begs the question then, seeing the great things you're doing with this and the new themes we're bringing out and the old themes that we're making new comment on, what's the next Tennessee William epic part that you would like to play?
Maggie.
Ah, there it is. There it is. Good, because I want to play Brick, so
okay,
we're in good shape.
Are we gonna
I love that.
Make that happen.
I love that. I saw that production in London with Ned Beatty and Brendan Fraser, and it was so shocking to see how these London people latched on to this American iconic piece too, and you realize how universal theater is.
I would have paid to see you in that show.
Oh, I'd love to do that. I'd love to do that.
We're planning on taking it on the road, right?
Is that what you're doing?
I love it.
Plans are starting here.
Now you said something. The name of the show is Streetcar Named Desire at Boston Court. Again, the website is www.bostoncourt.com or, of course, bostoncourt.org.
And tickets are priced between $20 and $39, folks. Come on. You can barely get Wendy's meals.
Yeah, that's right.
At the drive-thru. And you can get those tickets by calling 626-683-6801, as Andrew said. And don't just think about it. Do it, because this play, I don't remember it being done in more recent times here. So it's something important, especially this particular production, because of its point of view that its director has given it. So go out there, support the arts, and see this beautiful show.
And I think we've seen that people are very open to that with what Hamilton did, where you had such unique casting. And not only that, but you had the idea behind the casting that people are people, and an American experience is an American experience, that it has value as an American experience, regardless of who's playing it, you know, the power of the performer, which is something that hopefully, you know, worldwide will take on. And we'll really see some good things in the arts coming up here. But now, Michael.
Yeah, it's that
and
time.
Now. Embarrassing moments.
You can't get away. It's done. You have to stay here now. The sound effect has been played. I'm sorry. Do either of you have a story that might have been an embarrassing moment that might remind our young performers that even though things go wrong, ultimately they become a part of who you are and part of your career?
I want you to go first, because your story is awesome. Your story is awesome.
Well, I think yours will be shortly after I graduated from college, I went to USC, and we put together a theater company of a bunch of recent alums, and we were doing a production of a Peter Schaffer play called Black Comedy, which is a wonderful farce that takes place in an apartment in London on a very important night. And the first scene of the play, the lights are off on the stage, but the actors are moving around as though everything's fine, and then suddenly the lights come up and they say, what happened to the lights? So the convention is that when the lights are up, it's supposed to be black. When the lights are out, it's supposed to be light.
Right.
And they, you know, whenever somebody strikes a match or something, the lights dim on stage, etc. So that's the sort of convention. So we had a wonderful two-story set, and there was a platform for the bedroom upstairs, and the front edge of the platform didn't have legs. It had chains that went up to a pipe in the grid above. And on our opening night, a couple of characters were on the second story, and that pipe had not been, our TD had not carefully calculated what the weight load was on that.
No.
And it began to collapse, and the entire platform fell to the ground.
Oh, no.
A couple actors on top who were sort of clinging on as though they were falling down the Titanic as it was sinking.
It hit the ground?
It hit the ground.
Oh, no.
Narrowly missed. There were several people sitting on a sofa just downstage of it, so it narrowly missed decapitating investigating
all
of them.
Oh, my goodness.
But there was furniture scattered all over the play. An assistant stage manager who had been in the wings ran out on stage to see if everything was okay, then realized everyone was getting up and seemed all right and tried to creep off stage as though nothing had happened. And the characters in the play could not have known what had happened because while the lights were up, they were supposed to be the dark for them. So these actors bravely continued on and finished the play with the stage strewn with furniture and broken scenery.
And that story was about 1 foot of staging away from being a very sad story.
Exactly right.
Oh my goodness. Well, and that's interesting too, because that show is an amazing show as well, and it kind of throws the audience off anyways. They're off kilter anyways. This must have seemed very surreal, no doubt about it. Wow.
Maya Lynn,
what you got for us?
So a year ago, opening night, and I'm saying this, and opening night is literally 2 days away, so I'm like, we both have opening night. Opening night, I'm doing Future Sex, Inc. at the Lounge Theater. It's the first musical I've done in 10 years. I'm in six-inch heels. I'm rapping. I literally, like, rapping. And I've never rapped before in my life. And I have these two men, and they're strong, and they're flipping me over while I'm rapping. And then the next thing I know, I'm, like, on my neck, upside down.
Oh, no.
And I'm stuck. My fishnets are stuck on one of the men.
No.
So I'm rapping upside down, and I did not miss a beat, and I landed on my head. And and I just kept going, and the song was over, and then I had to climb up a ladder and go up a ramp. I was on autopilot, and
well,
about
I bet
5 minutes
you were adrenaline.
Later,
yeah,
I got off stage, and I said, "What happened?" And they said, "Do you think you can continue the show?" And I said, "Yes." And then I didn't go to sleep that night, but
wow,
I wanted to make sure I was okay.
Yeah, I'm sure. Did you have a concussion?
I didn't go to the doctor.
Right. Yeah.
To be perfectly honest, and I'm here, so.
Both of these stories are why you do the shows with young people. Because, man, if I fall down like that, I don't recover as quick anymore. Yeah. So that's amazing.
So,
wow.
Don't do that. Go get checked out, kids.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Yeah.
Head injuries are a serious thing. So we got to talk a little bit about the shows we've said here today.
Yeah.
Obviously, A Streetcar Named Desire at Boston Court. This is a new production, a production that's been updated, plays on new themes, does some really cool things with casting, as well as kind of reemphasizing what Tennessee Williams was originally talking about. We've obviously had a chance to talk to two people who are so great about that, but also Million Dollar Quartet. Michael, where can people get tickets for that?
Yes, at 3dtshows.org or 3dtheatricals.org online, and we are opening at the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts February 23rd through March 4th. It's an amazing experience and a very musical one at that.
Yeah, and obviously the Alamo playing at the Ruskin Group Theater, another great piece out there. But more importantly, Michael, like we've said many times here, get up, go see a play, go see the live arts and support live theater because it makes the world
Absolutely.
A better place and makes our own lives
Absolutely.
Better. A big thank you to both of our guests today.
Thank you, Maya Lynn. Thank you, Michael. It's so nice to see you again.
Really appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Michael. My name is Andrew David James.
I'm Michael Sterling.
Where will I see you next week?
On the radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.